ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय A reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 2, Remembrance of Lord Krishna. Kaumarim dashayam chestam. Rekshaniyam vajau kausham. Rudani vahasan mudha. Alasimhavalokana Kaumarim dasha Kaumarim dasha yamschestam Rekshaniyam rajaukausham Rudani vahashan mutha Bala Simhavalokana Kaumarim Dashayam Chestam Rikshaniyam Rajaukasham Rudani Vahasan Mukha Bala Simhavalokana Kaumarim dashayam chestam Rekshaniyam rajaukasham Rudani vahasan mukha Bala simhavalokana Kaumarim dashayam chestam Rikshaniyam vajaukasham Rudani vahasan mukha Bala simhavalokana Kaumarim dashayam chestam Rikshaniyam vajaukasham Rudani vahasan mukha Bala Simhavalokana suitable to childhood. Darshayan, while showing. Chestam, activities. Prakshaniyam,
worthy to be seen.
Raja Okshasam, by the inhabitants of the land of Vrindavan. Rudan, crying. Eva, just like. Hasan, laughing. Mukha, struck with wonder. Balasimha, lion cub. Avalokana, looking like that. Translation: when the Lord displayed his activities just suitable for childhood, he was visible only to the residents of Vrindavan. Sometimes he would cry and sometimes laugh, just like a child. And while doing so, he would appear like a lion cub. Please repeat. When the Lord displayed his activities just suitable for childhood, he was visible only to the residents of Vrindavan. Sometimes he would cry and sometimes laugh, just like a child. And while doing so, he would appear like a lion cub. Purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. If anyone wants to enjoy the childhood pastimes of the Lord, then he has to follow in the footsteps of the residents of Vraj, like Nanda, Upananda, and other parental inhabitants. A child may insist on having something and cry like anything to get it, disturbing the whole neighborhood. And then immediately after achieving the desired thing, he laughs. Such crying and laughing is enjoyable to the parents and elderly members of the family. So the Lord would simultaneously cry and laugh in this way and merge his devotee parents in the humor of transcendental pleasure. These incidents are enjoyable only by the residents of Vraj, like Nanda Maharaj, and not by the impersonalist worshippers of Brahman or Paramatma. Sometimes, when attacked in the forest by demons, Krishna would appear struck with wonder, but he looked on them like the cub of a lion and killed them. His childhood companions would also be struck with wonder, and when they came back home, they would narrate the story to their parents, and everyone would appreciate the qualities of their Krishna. Child Krishna did not belong only to his parents, Nanda and Yashoda. He was the son of all the elderly inhabitants of Vrindavan and the friend of all contemporary boys and girls. Everyone loved Krishna. He was the life and soul of everyone, including the animals, the cows, and the calves. Translation again. When the Lord displayed his activities just suitable for childhood, he was visible only to the residents of Vrindavan. Sometimes he would cry and sometimes laugh, just like a child, and while doing so, he would appear like a lion cub. Om majana tamandasha gananjana shalakaya chakshunitam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha shri chaitanya manobhishtam sabhitam yena bhutale svayarupa gadamayam dadati svavadantikam. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasari Gaura Bhaktavrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. I laughed a little bit when I was reading the purport, because where it says that a child may insist on having something and cry like anything to get it, disturbing the whole neighborhood. And then immediately after achieving the desired thing, he laughs. Such crying and laughing is enjoyable to the parents and elderly members of the family. So the Lord would simultaneously cry and laugh in this way and merge his devotee parents in the humor of transcendental pleasure. I laugh because you know the way the mind is extraordinarily powerful, but it's also extraordinarily fast. So the thoughts can go through the mind very, very quickly. So literally, as I was reading that, two thoughts came to my mind. One was a thought of annoyance at my own children. And the second thought was a chastening and humble reminder of how I was annoying to my parents. So I can remember well my children, particularly one of them. I won't say which, because he might be listening on the dreaded internet, you know, everyone listening. So, he wanted something. Boy, did he want something. And it was like tantrums extraordinaire, you know, rolling on the floor. It's like ecstatic symptoms in reverse, you know. It's like rolling on the floor and feet in the air and, you know, screaming and hollering. And they're able, I don't know if they do this deliberately, maybe it's subconscious, but they're able to freak out in such a way that it's almost like they're going to choke to death. They can't catch their breath, you know. It's like, and of course, that freaks you out, you know, and you think, well, I'm a parent, I suppose I should do something now. Of course, there's this false ego resistance as a parent to actually give them what they want, you know, because if you give them what they want, then it's like you've given in, you know. But it's exactly like that. You give them what they want, and it's like instantaneously, bang, it's like, ah. So it's just an act. It's completely 100% an act. But they stretch it so far to the symptoms of almost choking to death that you have to... Of course, my wife, you know, is such a, you know, soft touch. You know, it's like they only have to start, you know, and she'll give them what they want, you know. But on those occasions when their mother wasn't there, they must have dreaded those occasions, you know. You know, they had to go for at least 10 minutes. And... really looked like they needed hospital treatment before they got what they wanted. But then instantaneously, they were in bliss. Instantaneously in bliss. So this is exactly what's saying here. However, as a parent, I'm sorry, but, you know, of course, we're living in the material world, and the spiritual world, or the material world is a perverted reflection of the material world. This line, his devotee parents, his ordinance, in the humor of transcendental... So the Lord would simultaneously cry and laugh, and in this way, merge his devotee parents in the humor of transcendental pleasure. That part of it I didn't get, you know. I didn't get the pleasure part, you know. The first part was the frustration of them, you know, me being annoyed at their... I know what you're doing, okay, so you can't talk yet, but I know what you're doing, I know what you're trying to get, and then me giving in and giving them what they want. So that was... you know, an annoyance. And then when you give in to what they want, then you're thinking, God, he won again, you know. So the transcendental pleasure isn't something that I can particularly relate to. However, so that was one thought that came into my mind, all in a split second. It's taken me about 5 minutes to elaborate on it. The second thought was, when I was their age, actually a little bit older, I do remember one specific incident. It was Christmas time. And, you know, I'd written my note to Santa, all those who come from, you know, the Christian world, so to speak, will know about Santa. Or as those from the UK, you know, have to be different, and they call him Father Christmas, you know. Just to be different. anything to avoid doing the same as the Europeans, because they call him Santa Claus, which is a variation on the word Saint Nicholas. And St. Nicholas, of course, I think is originating somewhere from the Austrian area, Vienna and all that kind of thing. So the Brits have to be different, so they call him Father Christmas. Anyways, so I wrote my note to Santa Claus or to Father Christmas. And I wanted, I wanted a football kit. That's what I wanted. I was about eight or something, and it was my seven, eight, and I wanted my first football kit. And... sorry for getting, in one sense, getting off the subject of today, but just wanted to say this. I was a follower of a football team called Tottenham Hotspur. Some of you may know that football team. and I wanted the Tottenham Hotspur football kit. So on Christmas morning, you know, you wake up really early and you're all excited and you go downstairs. And I came from a relatively large family, being a Catholic family. I had three brothers and two sisters. So we're all down there, but the rule was you had to wait for your parents to come down. And of course, they're a little bit later than the children. And we're all there again, you know, about to develop ecstatic symptoms of freaking out. And of course, you don't actually do that. You go upstairs to your parents' bedroom and you wake them up. And get them up to come downstairs. Anyway, they came downstairs, we opened our presents were there. We opened our presents, we took the wrapping paper off. And inside my wrapping paper was a sports bag. And the sports bag had, you know, Tottenham Hotspur Football Club on it, you know. But it was a sports bag. I wanted a football kit. So what did I do? Even though I was 7 or 8, rolling on the floor, freaking out, throwing a tantrum, complete hump, and really causing my parents loads and loads of grief. Until my father unzipped the bag, and inside the bag was the football kit. So I'm just thinking as I'm reading this that I can relate to both scenarios, you know, to being a parent and being, you know, sort of frustrated and annoyed with children. But then I can think back and I can remember how I was equally an equal disturbance to my parents, and particularly my father. Okay, so that was just the thought that came into mind as I was reading. So reading the purport, and that point about that I'm making about understanding the having that experience of Nanda Maharaj and Yashoda Devi, having that experience that they're merging in this transcendental pleasure. You know, that's what it is. It's transcendental pleasure. And it's interesting, also in the purport, we read this word there, if I can quickly get it. And everyone would appreciate the qualities of their Krishna. So, and then Prabhupada explains, it's not just Nanda Maharaj. He mentions Upananda, you know, Krishna's uncle there, and all the inhabitants of Vrindavan, their Krishna. Krishna did not only belong to his parents, but he was the son of all the elderly inhabitants of Vrindavan and a friend of all the contemporary boys and girls. Everyone loved Krishna, yet he was the life and soul of everyone. We have that phrase in English, the life and soul of the party. You know, this understanding that we want to imitate who Krishna is, or we want to be Krishna, actually. And that's why we're here in the material world trying to learn that lesson. So here, Krishna was the life and soul of everyone. In the material world, many people have that desire. They want to be the life and soul of everything, the life and soul of the party. But they're Krishna. So that's also available for us. We can also be part of, in one sense we are already part of Krishna's family, but we also can be part of Krishna's family and enjoy these transcendental pastimes and this transcendental pleasure. But right now, we're not doing that. That's not our position. Of course, we're in the run-up now to Janmashtami, the appearance day of Lord Krishna. And of course, in Bhagavad Gita, we learn Janma Karma Chame Divyam, that if one understands the transcendental nature of Krishna's appearance, if we actually understand that transcendental appearance of Krishna, and his activities. Krishna isn't niskriya. He's not without activities. He actually has activities. He's active the whole time like that. And that's what Prabhupada's also saying in the purport. And Prabhupada actually says in the purport that it's not available to the impersonalist worshippers of Brahman or Paramatma. So even the impersonal worshippers of Paramatma. But particularly Brahman and particularly the Mayavadis, this isn't available because they deny the existence of Krishna. So naturally they deny Krishna's activities. So simultaneously, in our situation, the reason that we're in the material world is that we're in that realm. We're in that realm as the Prabhupada, we understand, came to destroy impersonalism and voidism. So we're in this category of course, as the aspiring devotees, we're trying to, you know, purify our existence and reconnect with Krishna on that transcendental level and develop a relationship with Krishna. But what's actually preventing us from doing that? What's preventing us from having this relationship with Krishna? Because Krishna's in our hearts as Paramatma, as Super Soul. Krishna's there all the time. And that's also interesting, that no matter what journey we take in the material world, and we understand that the journeys that we can take in the material world can be extraordinarily hellish. They can be just, I mean, even living in this particular body, we can identify hellish aspects to just existing in this body. But it can get a lot worse in the material world, a lot worse. So it's very good for us to meditate on that, to give us, to use as an impetus to absorb ourselves more in our spiritual activities and our devotional service. But Krishna is extraordinarily merciful insofar as no matter what existence we ever have in this material world, no matter how far, how deep, how low we plunge in this material world, Krishna will always accompany us. He will always accompany us on that journey. He will never, ever, ever abandon us. We know in the material world, we have this phrase, I don't know if we all have this phrase, but one phrase, you have best friends. And then among your best friends, because everybody wants to be special. We all want to be special. We all want to be loved, and we all want to give love. Actually, it's just the quality of the living entity. We all want to be loved, and we all want to give love. So you have your best friends. But then among your best friends, you get into this kind of thing where you have your bestest friend, you know? Because everybody wants that special relationship like that. So, but with friends in the material world, and I'm sure all of you have experienced this to one degree or another, and it can be extraordinarily painful, that sometimes your best friend, one of your best friends, or your bestest friend, or one of your bestest friends, actually lets you down. You know, sometimes in a very, dramatic way, that there's an unexpected, totally unfair, and maybe callous way. And it can be really soul-destroying and heartbreaking because you really thought you had a deep relationship with that person. But with Krishna, he never does that. No matter where we go in the material world, whatever sojourn we take, Krishna will always accompany us. So, as we also understand from Bhagavad Gita, from Srimad Bhagavatam, we simply just have to turn to Krishna. He's in our heart. We simply just have to turn to him and accept him as our friend. So why do we not do that? Why is it always done? It's like two magnets coming together with the wrong, pointing the wrong ends to each other. It's like this, or it's like walking up an escalator that's coming down, you know. It's achievable, you can do it, particularly when you're young. You know, when you get a little bit older, it's a little harder. You also look pretty stupid. I don't know if you've ever had that experience, that you walk on an escalator and then you realize, actually, it's the wrong one. But then you think, oh, I don't care, this is a challenge, I'll take this on, you know, and you try to put it on. But anyway, it's difficult. You know, material world's like that. Sometimes, you know, it's like swimming through thick sweet rice. It's very, very difficult, the material world. So, turning to Krishna. Philosophically, it's a really easy thing to do. But the resistance that we find ourselves engaged in when we try to do it is quite intense, quite amazing. So why is that? Why is that? I was reading recently where it was a lecture, actually, this year, but I was reading it, I wasn't listening to it. And what I was understanding that Srila Prabhupada was inferring was that one of the reasons why that's so difficult to turn and accept Krishna is because we're afraid to acknowledge that we're a person. We're actually afraid to acknowledge that we're a person. We're an eternal spirit soul, we have an eternal personality, and we are an eternal person. But we're actually afraid to acknowledge that. And that's actually one of the main barriers that's preventing us. Because until we acknowledge that, accept it, embrace it, and really, really want it. It's already there, so it's not a question of wanting it, but really, really realize it. And think, yes, I am an eternal person. And I have an eternal personality, and I have an eternal relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But we're afraid to acknowledge that. So why? Why are we afraid to acknowledge that we're an eternal person? Because part of that acknowledgement and part of that accepting that we're an eternal person means what? It means that we have to give up the very thing that has been preaching to us since time immemorial we don't know how long, how many billions of lifetimes that we may have spent in this material world. We just don't know. But however long we've spent in this material world, this thing has been preaching to us that we are not a person. That's what it's been doing. It's been preaching to us constantly that we are not a person, and therefore, that's what makes it so difficult. So what is that thing that's preaching to us? It's our false ego. Our false ego is constantly telling us, no, we are the center, we are this body, we are these senses, simply enjoy the mind, enjoy the senses. That's what it's preaching to us the whole time. It's effectively telling us we're not an eternal person. And until we can overcome that preaching, until we can out-preach, I'm sure you've often experienced, you know, when you meet somebody and they're challenging and you want to present them Krishna consciousness, you know, you have to be able to, you know, out-preach them, you know, with the philosophy, with logic, with reason, with argument. So that's exactly what we have to do with the false ego. We have to be able to out-preach the false ego. Krishna tells us in the Matchita Sarvadurgani verse in the 18th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. He tells us, if we don't do this, and if we surrender to our false ego, and if we listen to our false ego, and don't actually listen to him, we will be lost. That's the phrase Krishna uses. We will be lost. I don't know, I can again remember another childhood pastime I had when I was on holidays in Brighton, which I'm sure Janani Vas Prabhu and Pankajami Prabhu know very well, on the south coast of England. I think I was about 5 at the time, and it was the middle of summer, and it was a nice day. Hey, a nice day in England, nice summer's day in England. And Brighton was packed. There were thousands of people on the seafront, etc., etc. And somehow or another, because I was spacing out, looking this way, looking that way, I got detached from my family, from my parents and brothers and sisters, and I got lost. And I remember just feeling so, so freaked out and desolate and isolated and vulnerable and afraid and fearful. And that's what we all experience in this material world, you know? You know, in those quiet moments when we're reflective about our situation, and when we think about, you know, leaving our body, you know, it's like we just need all the support and all the all the friendship and all the connection to Krishna that we can possibly have. We don't want to be lost in that situation. But if we're acting on the false ego platform and allowing our false ego to defeat us, that's what will happen. That's ultimately what will happen. So we have to preach to our false ego, obviously associate with devotees, read the philosophy, chant Hare Krishna, pray for Krishna's mercy. But really think about this very, very seriously, that that's what we've got to do, because that false ego is telling us that we're not an eternal person. And as long as we are listening to that message, we cannot develop that relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And we'll never, ever get to the point where we can experience this transcendental ecstasy that the residents of Vrindavan have and are experiencing. When I was asked to give class, they asked me also to talk about, you know, Krishna's pastimes or, like that. And, you know, I always feel a little, hesitant to do that. I kind of prefer speaking sort of more basic philosophy than Krishna's pastime. But because I was asked, I will actually relay one pastime. And again, you know, in one sense, we have no right to, in one sense, we have no right to hear these pastimes. Because of our fallen condition and our fallen state, that you know, they can be misinterpreted, or we can take them lightly. It's such an easy thing, actually, to take those things lightly. Two things. One is to take them lightly and think somehow or another, you know, we're already part of this kind of thing, this kind of entourage, almost, because here we are in Shridhar Mayapur, which is the spiritual world, and we're associating with devotees, we're chanting Hare Krishna. But we still have to be very, very careful, because we still have many, or at least I should speak in the first person, have many, many anartas to overcome. So that's one thing. And then the other thing, there can be a tendency also, particularly in the neophyte stage, to consider these things, how can they be true? How can these things actually be true? So this pastime certainly falls into that category. And I was reading it not so long ago. What attracted me to it, and why I thought I would speak about it, was actually the description of Kutila, the description of her, because I could relate to it so much. She was described, or at least her mind was described, as being crooked. So that immediately resonated with me. A crooked mind. And what was the other? What's Kutila's? What's the other description of Kutila? She's got a crooked mind. And anyone help me now? I've forgotten what the other quality was. But certainly the crooked mind really appealed to me. So this pastime was that Srimati Radharani and her gopi friends, they decided during the cold month, actually January, February, they decided that they would take bath in the early morning bath in the Yamuna. So they were doing that. They were going early in the morning, taking bath. As a vow, you know, as a vrat for the cold months like that. I'm not sure what they did. Well, in the warm months, of course, it wouldn't be so much of a vrat, right? Because the water would be nice and warm. Yeah, okay. Anyway, so they decided to do that. And Kutila got to hear about it. She got to hear that this is what they were doing. So again, her crooked mind, you know, immediately started to be suspicious. What are they doing? What are they up to? Where are they going at this time in the morning? So then she found out, either she followed them or she asked somebody, whatever. Anyway, she found out this is what they were doing. So then again, her crooked mind, she wanted to know what Krishna was doing. So she made some excuse the next morning. She made some excuse to go to Nandagram early. And she inquired where Krishna was. And somebody told her, Krishna's gone to the Yamuna to take bath. So then it was like, you know. Actually, it's also very interesting because material world's like that as well, you know. You know, we can put two and two together and make five and be totally convinced it's true. Of course, in this case, it may have been true, by the way, what Kutila was surmising. But it's another interest. I may have told this story before, I'm not sure, it's quite short. But again, when I was a young kid, in school though, so I was again, you know, six, seven, that kind of age. It was the day after my birthday. And on my birthday, my mother always used to, not bake actually, unfortunately, but she used to buy these big sponge cakes. They were triple layered, you know, and in between each layer was like loads of jam and cream, you know, and loads of sugar and, you know, anyway. And so it was the day after my birthday. And I had all my friends around, and we just did the big highlight of the birthday. Aside from me getting my presents, of course, that was a highlight. Birthdays as well, it's all I, me, and mine, you know. Anyway, so the big highlight was cutting the cake and eating the cake, and you would stuff your face with the cake until you could eat no more, you know, and it was all creamy and jammy and spongy and sugary, and you just enjoy a big, thick sponge cake. Next day, I'm in school. And normally at that age, we'd only do maths and English and that type of thing. But for some reason, the teacher that day, a lady, that was our teacher, she decided to do a little bit of geography. And for whatever reason, she started to talk about sponges under the sea. And I was thinking, you know, this is weird. Why would anybody want to put a sponge under the sea? It'd get all soggy and salty. I mean, you know, why would you want to do that? That's absolutely crazy. So I don't know how long I held that thought for, but it was probably a year, maybe even 2 years. I don't know how long it was. Of course, I wasn't thinking about it every day, you know. And we didn't have Wikipedia and Google in those days either, you know. So it wasn't that I was meditating it all the time. But every time that thought came into my mind, I would just think, that was a really weird thing that the teacher talked about, you know, sponges under the sea. Anyway, a year or two later, can't remember exactly when, I came home from school one day and my brother was sitting there and he was watching the television. And for anybody of my age, my generation, you might remember a TV program called, in the UK of course, called The Wonderful World of Jacques Cousteau. Actually, maybe you know that in France too, given his name, Jacques Cousteau. So he was an underwater explorer and he used to explore all things under the sea. So there I am sitting watching the television, and next thing, Jacques is under the water with his thing on, and his thing on his back, his oxygen thing on, and he's talking about sponges under the sea. And I went, ah, that's what she was talking about. Anyway, the reason I mention that is that actually the material world and all the different combinations of possibilities, we should never, even when we jump to conclusions, we should jump back. Because you just never know what twist or what turn may be there. And particularly when we're, quote unquote, passing judgment on other people, on other devotees, you always have to be super, super careful, because you just don't know what twist or what turn might be there that changes, completely changes your impression of a situation. Anyway, so that happened to me as a kid. So Kutila, she immediately, when she learned that Krishna's leaving at this time in the morning as well, okay, put two and two together and I get four and I know what they're up to and I'm gonna really sort this out, because, you know, Abhimanyu is my brother, and my brother, this is outrageous, you know, that his wife is up to some nonsense with Krishna. So what did she do? She decided, she didn't know exactly where they went, but she decided to go in the general direction, and then she was looking for Krishna's lotus feet so she could follow Krishna's lotus feet to find out where they're going. And fortunately, before she got to where they actually were, because they were actually together in a little house, a bower as they call it, a flower house, a sort of forest house, I think it was Tulsi Devi wasn't in there. She was outside, or a little bit outside, and she saw Kutila coming, and she put two and two together also. Ah, oh, Kutila! You know, it's Kutila! Kutila is almost like the Hiranyakashipu of Krishna Leela kind of thing, you know. So it's kind of like, Kutila. So she goes running, and runs into the forest house, and Kutila's coming, quick, what are we going to do? And of course all the gopis start freaking, what are we going to do? And Krishna says, no, it's okay, don't worry. Not a problem, you know. Krishna's like this, you know, super cool superhero. It's kind of like you take all the superheroes that we know, every one of them, you merge them all together, and you multiply them by maybe, you know, as many lifetimes as we've all collectively had in the material world. Multiply them by that, and then you're kind of getting close to Krishna being, how much of a superhero Krishna is, you know. It's like the Olympic Games is taking place now. If Krishna competed, he'd just win every gold medal, you know, and probably the silver and the bronze as well, you know. So he's just like, you know, he's Krishna. So he says, not a problem. And he says, what I'll do is, I'll just disguise myself as Abhimanyu. So I'm not sure exactly how he, you know, got Abhimanyu's clothes and all that. Maybe he did what Superman does, you know, goes in the telephone box. But anyway, he then managed to dress up as Abhimanyu, and he left the treehouse where he was with Radha and the gopis, and he then walked on the path that Kutila was coming on. So they met each other, and Kutila was really surprised. Ah, Abhimanyu! Oh, well, I think Abhimanyu spoke first when he saw her coming. He says, "Oh, Hare Krishna, Kutila." In of course Abhimanyu's voice. If I knew what Abhimanyu's accent was like, I'd probably try to imitate it, but fortunately I don't know what his accent was like, so I won't be able to imitate it. But so he said, you know, Hare Krishna, hello, Hari Bol, whatever the greeting was. And Kutila was really surprised, you know, and said, oh, Abhimanyu, what are you doing here? Why are you here down here? He says, oh, you know, earlier or yesterday we lost one of our bulls, or one of our cows, or bulls like that, and, you know, I'm looking for it, trying to find it, and I'm looking here and there and everywhere, trying to find it, and, you know, I'm a little disturbed, and hopefully I'll be able to find it. Why are you here? What are you doing here, Kutila? And she says, crooked mind. She says, what I'm doing here is I have it on good authority that both Radha, your wife, and Krishna are both in the Yamuna taking bath, and I've come to find out what's going on. And then Abhimanyu says, yes. Even more painful for my heart is not losing the cow or the bull, but even more painful is, you know, this relationship that my wife has with Krishna. Yes, please find out what's going on and tell me. He says, yes, you go searching, and I will be, he tells her where he's going. He says he's going to hide somewhere for a little while. You go and find out what's happening and come and tell me, report to me, let me know what's going on. So she does that. So then she goes searching, and she's searching in all the places she can look and find. And eventually, of course she wasn't too far away, but eventually she finds this particular forest house. And outside are some of the gopis and Radha. And Lalita is one of the gopis that's there, and she then greets Kutila and says, good morning, Kutila. Have you come to the Yamuna to bathe like that? And she says, no, I haven't. She says, I want to know what you're doing here. And Lalita says, we've come to bathe in the Yamuna. And she says, yes. I don't know the exact dialogue, I'm ad-libbing now a little bit, you know, but I think this is what you would call, if it was in the material world, the perverted reflection in the material world, I think they get into what we call a kind of a bit of a cat fight. And, you know, so they're having this backwards and forwards, and they ask Kutila again, what's she doing? She says, I've come to find Hari. And in Sanskrit, Hari can also be interpreted as meaning a lion. And Lalita says, that's fantastic. Thank you for warning us about the lion. Now we'll take the necessary steps to protect ourselves. And this, of course, just winds up Kutila even more, you know, because she's like that, and they're going backwards and forwards. And then she starts criticizing her and saying, what are you doing? And she also says that she can also smell, you know, Krishna. But she immediately says, just see. And then Radha's also there. And then she points to Radha and gets really angry at Radha and says, this is your necklace. This is Krishna's garland. I am going to tell, you know, your husband. I'm going back to tell my mother, Jatila. I'm going back to tell Purnamasi. And I'm going to make a big scandal. You can imagine if they had the internet, you know, before she'd even get back to Vraj, you know, it would be on, we won't mention that website, but it would be on that website. And it would already be out of control. But she said, that's what I'm doing. I'm going back and I'm telling everybody. So she leaves. She brings the necklace and the garland with her. And she goes back. And she goes back to Abhimanyu, who she thinks is Abhimanyu, who's just down the road a little bit. And she goes back to Abhimanyu and she says, look what I've got. I found, you know, Radha's necklace. And of course, Radharani denies it. She says, no, that necklace is not mine. That necklace is, I think she actually says that necklace is Abhimanyu's. And she denied. But she says to Abhimanyu, it's Krishna, of course, but she's thinking she's saying it to Abhimanyu, look, I found the necklace and the garland, I have it. Look, we've caught them. So Abhimanyu says, this is terrible. How can they do this? You know, this is outrageous. I am going to report it to King Kamsa. I am going to get Kamsa to come with his army and come to protect all the women of Vrindavan and Mathura, to protect all the women from Krishna. I'm going to get Kamsa to come and take him away. And Kutila's fired up like anything. She thinks this is absolutely fantastic. You know, yes, Hari Bol, Jai Jai. So then as he says, let me take those two things. I should take those two things as evidence to show to Kamsa. And just before he goes, he says to her the last thing. He says, but Kutila, better you don't tell anybody about this. I know now, that's the most important thing. And because if you tell somebody, it might get around. It will get around. And then what will happen is Nanda Maharaj and Yashoda will become very protective of their son. And they will come, they'll take him away and they'll bring him somewhere. And then Kamsa won't be able to arrest him because they will be in hiding. So please don't tell anybody. And Kutila, yes, very good idea. Absolutely, I won't breathe a word to anybody. So then Putila goes back home. She goes back home to her mother, to the house. And Abhimanyu, who's actually Krishna, he then spends an hour or two in the forest engaging in some more pastimes, but pretending, spending the time, because he's pretending that he's gone to Mathura to see Kamsa or whatever. Or I think he actually went to somebody else to send it, forget them to send a message to Kamsa, actually. He didn't go all the way. But anyway, so he spends a little time away. And then he comes back, dressed as Abhimanyu again, and he comes back to the house. And in the house is Kutila and Jatila. They're in the house. Unfortunately, because Krishna's Krishna, Abhimanyu, the real Abhimanyu, has not returned yet. He hasn't returned. If that was me trying to play that prank, the person who I'm trying, they'd already have returned, and the game would be up and I'd be exposed. But Krishna being Krishna, he wasn't exposed. And so he comes back, and then he tells them, he says, okay, and Radharani's also there, and he says, okay, I'm going to take Radha into the inner sanctum of the house, because she cannot see or she cannot smell Krishna, because something weird happens when she sees or smells Krishna. She gets kind of illusioned. So I'm going to take her into the inner sanctum of the house, so that can't happen, to protect her. And you wait here until Kamsa comes, and then he can come and he can take Krishna away. Now, one thing you should know, and he's speaking to Jatila and Kutila, he says, one thing that you should know is that I have been informed that Abhimanyu is dressed up like me. He's pretending to be me. So when he comes, you should be up on the balcony and you should have an unlimited supply of, you know, packed mud, earth, balls, like that. And when he comes, you simply shout all the abuse you can think of at him, and you throw as many of these mud balls at him, and try to break his head, is actually the phrase that's used. So they say, absolutely, definitely, what a rascal, he's dressing up as you, what a nonsense this Krishna is, you know, he's such a rascal. So Abhimanyu, Krishna, sorry, dressed as Abhimanyu, goes into the inner sanctum of the house with Radha, and they then engage in all the pastimes that they were engaging in the forest house. And then 20 minutes, half an hour later, Krishna comes, or Abhimanyu comes. Abhimanyu comes. Oh, now I'm getting confused myself. Abhimanyu comes as himself. Sorry, Abhimanyu is coming as himself. But they're thinking it's Krishna dressed as Abhimanyu. So as he comes, what do? They follow the instruction that Abhimanyu has just given, who's actually Krishna, has given the instruction, but they're thinking it's Abhimanyu. And they just start pelting him with these mud balls. And he just thinks they've gone completely crazy. And he decides, well, what else can I do? I better go off and I better get, as it's described in the pastime, get an exorcist to come and exorcise the ghosts that have overtaken Kutila and Jatila. And then Krishna, he goes on with his pastimes. Hare Krishna. That wasn't planned, but it's actually 9 o'clock, which is kind of good timing to end. I suppose I should ask if anybody has a comment or a question. Just keep the questions easy, please. But if anyone has a comment or a question, please feel free. Otherwise, we can go and take prasadam, honor prasadam. We're okay? Fantastic. Srila Prabhupada ki. Yeah.